की जाए। प्रेम श्री कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री द्वैत गदाधर हर श्रीवासदि कौर भक्तवृंद की जय। श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गौर गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंड राधा कुंड गिरि गोवर्धन की जय। वृंदावन धाम की जय। मथुरा धाम की जय। नवद्वीप मायापुर धाम की जय। जगन्नाथ पुरी धाम की जय। गंगा माई जमुना देवी की जय। भक्ति देवी की जय। तुलसी महारानी की जय। समवेत भक्तवृंद की जय। और प्रेमानंद All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityananda. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pachani Namaste Sisunavati Paskachade Sitarani. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shri Rupam Sadhvajatam Saganai Avinatham Vitam Stam Sajiva Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Padam Saganam Avita Shri Vishakam Vitashta Vajikam Pachubhisha Pukasam Vyavita Pichinam Pavaneva Vajikam Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 It's February 4th, 2017 in Brisbane, Australia, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 1. Questions by the sages, text 16. Kova Bhagavatastasya.
Kova Bhagavatastasya.
Punya Shloke Jakarmana.
Punya Shloke Jakarmana.
Shuri Kamo na Shrinuya.
Shuri Kamo na Shrinuya.
Yashakali Mahapalam. Malapalam.
Mahapalam.
Please check.
Kova Bhagavatastasya.
Kaha.
Kaha.
Who?
Who?
Ba.
Ba.
Rather.
Rather.
Bhagavataha.
Bhagavataha.
Of the Lord.
Of the Lord.
Tasya.
Tasya.
His.
His.
Punya.
Punya.
Virtuous.
Virtuous.
Shloka Idya.
Shloka Idya.
Worshipable by prayers.
Worshipable by prayers.
Karmanaha.
Karmanaha.
Deeds.
Deeds.
Shuddhi Kamaha.
Shuddhi Kamaha.
Desiring deliverance from all sins.
Desiring deliverance from all sins.
Na.
Na.
Not.
Not.
Shunuyat.
Shunuyat.
Does hear.
Does hear.
Yeshaha.
Yeshaha.
Glories.
Glories.
Kali.
Kali.
Of the age of quarrel.
Of the age of quarrel.
Mala Apaham.
Mala Apaham.
The agent for sanctification.
The agent for sanctification.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Who is there, desiring deliverance from the vices of the age of quarrel, who is not willing to hear the virtuous glories of the Lord? Purport. The age of Kali is the most condemned age due to its quarrelsome features. Kali Yuga is so saturated with vicious habits that there is a great fight at the slightest misunderstanding. Slight misunderstanding, great fight. Those who are engaged in the pure devotional service of the Lord, who are without any desire for self-aggrandizement, and who are freed from the effects of fruitive actions and dry philosophical speculations, are capable of getting out of the entanglements of this complicated age. The leaders of the people are very much anxious to live in peace and friendship, but they have no information of the simple method of hearing the glories of the Lord. On the contrary, such leaders are opposed to the propagation of the glories of the Lord. In other words, the foolish leaders want to completely deny the existence of the Lord. In the name of the secular state, such leaders are enacting various plans every year. But by the insurmountable intricacies of the material nature of the Lord, all these plans for progress are being completely frustrated. They have no eyes to see that their attempts at peace and friendship are failing. But here's the hint to get over the hurdle. If we want actual peace, we must open the road to understanding of the Supreme Lord Krishna and glorify him for his virtuous activities as they are depicted in the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Kova Bhagavatastasya Punya Shloke Jakarmana Shuddhi Kamo Nishrinu Yad Yastyakali Malapaham, who is there desiring deliverance from the vices of the age of quarrel, who is not willing to hear the virtuous glories of the Lord? So here the main fault of the age of Kali is what?
Quarrelsomeness.
Slight difference of opinion, big fight. Is this our experience? Do we have this experience?
Sometimes.
Well, if you never interact with anybody, then it might be. But, you know, if you have any interaction with the world, it's constant. Especially now that there's the internet. I mean, seriously, before there was the internet, it wasn't so easy. If you wanted to quarrel with somebody, especially if you wanted to involve 100 people in your quarrel, or 1,000 people in your quarrel, it was expensive. You know, you had to write up a big paper, and then you had to print up 100 copies of it, and then you had to do a bulk mailing all over the world. Right? That was the way it had to be done. I mean, I remember when the whole Ritvik thing first came out. It wasn't internet. It was being printed in the Vedic Village Review. There were two devotees propounding it in the Vedic Village Review and mailing out copies to all the temples of their philosophy. But now if you want to involve, thousands or millions of people in quarrel, it's very easy. You know, you just turn on your computer and you write something on your blog or you comment on social media or something. I don't use Twitter, but you just, you know, send out a little thing on Twitter and you practically blow up the world. So this is what's going on. And does this go on in the Hare Krishna movement, or are we immune to this? We are definitely not immune to this. It's not only the politicians. Prabhupada's talking about secular state. It's not only politicians and secular states where they're saying, okay, we're going to remove religion from our public discourse, that are having this problem. And does this problem go on in other religions? Is ISKCON the only religious spiritual organization that has this problem? It goes on in every religious and spiritual society. You know, sometimes people think, well, there's a lot of quarreling in ISKCON, so let me join a different spiritual society. And then they find very, very quickly that there's quarreling there. Right? Or in families. You know, sometimes people won't talk to each other for 20 or 30 years over a little thing. Isn't that a fact? It's some little thing. Mom gave you that painting in the will. She didn't give it to me. And they don't talk. Finally, when they're on their deathbed, you know, they'll say, okay, I'll see my brother now that I'm dying. And the fight can go on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And pretty soon it becomes about something else. Isn't it? Right? You don't even remember what you fought about in the beginning. You remember, oh, there was a fight. What was it about? I don't know. And you're fighting about something else, and then you're fighting about something else, and then you're fighting about something else. And it's almost constant. You know, it's hard to go through a day unless you just isolate yourself completely. We're not exposed to this kind of quarreling. And, you know, of course, we all think it's very, 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 very important. You know, Prabhupada says slightest misunderstanding. But we don't think like that. We think it's very important. I mean, I was just talking to a devotee who was so emotional about what kind of honorifics are being used between devotees in a certain project. How the devotees are speaking to each other in one particular project. And she was just... It was the world was ending. You know, ISKCON would lose its purity and nobody would go back to Godhead and nobody would be a devotee anymore and nobody would be trained properly. I mean, it was just this... Anyway, she was going on and on and on for days and days and days and days. And then at one point she said to me, you know, well, I have also our problems. I'm not even chanting 16 rounds. I'm like, so you're worried about the exact words that devotees use to speak to each other? You know, do they call them Prabhu or Prabhi? And you don't even chant your rounds? And it's like, so it seems so important to us. It seems like it's the world's ending. And each of us, I think, have our issues like this, yes? I mean, I know I do. I have certain things that I just think are super important. Yes? Do we each have something like this? Where we get very emotional. And we're just going to write to everybody and tell everybody and make sure everybody knows that they're wrong. Because it really matters. And Prabhupada says here some very interesting things about what's not the solution and what is the solution. So he says that if you eliminate God, then whatever solutions you come up with are not going to work. And he says, can't they see that? He says they have no eyes to see that it's not working. And Prabhupada gives the example of the United Nations. He said they're supposed to be united nations, but they become fractured nations. The nations are breaking up into smaller and smaller. That's evidence that people can't get along, right? When quarrels get so bad that you have to sever the relationship, isn't it? That's the ultimate evidence that quarrels are that bad. So the nations are splitting up. Not Czechoslovakia, it's Czech Republic and Slovakia. And you go there and they'll say, you know, we Czechs are really different from the Slovaks. And you're there and you're thinking, really? You know, and this is the different flags. Okay, now we have to have this country and that country and this country and that country. You know, right now in America, California is practically trying to secede from the United States. They're passing all these laws and setting up all these commissions so the new president of America can't impose his will on their state. You know, in Canada, Quebec has been talking about secession for a long time. Northern Ireland. So, although I have all their plans, it simply is becoming more and more and more fractured. People are becoming more separated. On a family level, they're becoming more separated. On a community level, more separated. On a national level. The problem is they don't have the eyes to see that it's not working. So as soon as you eliminate God from the picture and say, we're going to have a secular state, then that doesn't work. But you could say, well, even people who have a religious state or even people in a religion are also fighting. We're also fighting in the Hare Krishna movement. Please find me a center in the Hare Krishna movement where there's no quarrel over insignificant things. I would like to go there. I mean, some are a lot worse than others. There are certain temples where the fighting is so endemic that it's constant, and no matter who they put in charge, there's fighting. I mean, two temples, particularly in the world. Please don't ask me what they are in a class because I won't tell you. But I can think of two temples, particularly in the world, where the politics is constant. It's just constant. And it doesn't matter who the GVC is, it doesn't matter who the temple president is, it just never, ever ends. And as soon as they put somebody new in charge, then everybody criticizes that person. It's just going on and on and on. And then other temples or in other communities where it's slight. You know, you can go for many months without hearing any kind of big altercation. And I've been in some temples where people are physically fighting. Actually, literally, there's physical fights in the temples. So we have a wide variety in our ISKCON movement as to which centers are, you know, some centers are particularly peaceful, some communities are particularly peaceful and particularly respectful, and others are particularly quarrelsome. But I don't know of any center where there's no quarrels over slight things. I haven't seen such a community or such a place. So you can say, well, it's not just whether you're secular or whether you're religious. That's not the only demarcation. And some of the fighting goes on between parts of a religion, like between Catholics and Protestants, or between Sunnis and Shiites. And we've had, I mean, I'd say some of the worst fights among our Gaudiya Vaishnavas have been between Gaudiya groups. Yes? Any of you familiar at all with our... history, so sometimes we fight more with another Gaudiya group than we're fighting with the impersonalists and the Rakshasas. So the fact that it's about God, and even that it's about Krishna, doesn't completely solve the problem. So Prabhupada gives a little hint here. He says, without any desire for self-aggrandizement, and are free from the results of fruitive activities and dry philosophical speculations. That gives us a little hint as to why just being ostensibly religious or ostensibly spiritual, talking about God officially, that isn't enough. That there has to be some quality there. So we're going to get back to that if we're still in this body and able to speak in half an hour. We will get back to that point, Krishna willing. But first I want to look at just why does the glorification of the Lord stop quarrel? What's the principle? Why does that work? I mean, there's so many means to stop quarrel. You can go to any bookstore, brick and mortar or virtual, and you can find so many books about how to get along, isn't it? So many. Empathic listening, nonviolent communication are some of the big ones that I can pick. But there's just so many. On and on and on and on and on. So many courses you can take, so many seminars you can take about how to get along, how to stop this quarrel over petty things. So why the glorification of the Lord? Why is that the solution? So the main reason that it's the solution is it changes our consciousness. It changes our view of things. We quarrel because, very quite simply, we think we're right and somebody else is wrong. That's just simply putting it quite simply. And we think that the wrong of somebody else matters. If you say, I don't like lentils, and I say lentils are delicious, I'm probably not going to quarrel with you about it because I realize that it has no meaning. There's no effect on me. There's no effect on the world. So it's where I think I'm right, and I think you're wrong, and I believe that if your opinion stands, then there'll be some ill effect. And generally, I'm concerned about an ill effect for me. Although I may cover that by saying it's an ill effect for my family, or it's an ill effect for ISKCON, or it's an ill effect for the world, or something like that. It won't please Srila Prabhupada, or I may say that. But generally, the things we fight about are things that we feel are going to adversely affect ourselves. Because there's a whole lot of things that people could be wrong about that might be damaging to the Hare Krishna movement or damaging to the world, but if they don't personally affect me, I'm not so likely to get all hot about it. Isn't that true? And if you're not sure about that, then start paying attention that things that people say and things that people do that you're convinced are wrong and you're convinced are damaging and are bad, but have no effect on you at all, are you likely to fight about it? Somebody else might fight about it, but you can examine, am I likely to fight about it? This is a little homework assignment, home fun assignment. Sorry, I asked the teacher to give a class, give homework assignments. So if you just start noting, what things do I get upset about, and what things am I likely to argue about, and what things are likely to argue about relentlessly? It'll be something that affects us personally. Although we generally try to cover that. No, it's not about me. It's not about me. It's about the principle. It's about Srila Prabhupada. It's about anything other than me. But if we're honest, that's not the case. So glorifying the Lord changes how we perceive things. The modes of nature and the levels of consciousness color our perception. It's like having a certain kind of filter. You know, you could put on different color glasses that have you see the world differently. And once you have these filters, you actually see the world differently. It's just like what a living being perceives as good food depends on the mode of that living being. If you're a rabbit, you think it's grass. You know, but if you're a tiger, you don't think it's grass. A tiger doesn't look at grass and see food. It's the same grass, but it's perceived as food to one entity and not food to another. What we perceive as a threat depends upon our filter. There are things that I'll feel very threatened by that other people will not. And this depends on what's coloring my perception of the world. What beliefs I have about what's right and what's wrong. How I understand respect also. A person can behave in a certain way that one person will feel insulted by and another person will not. Isn't that correct? The exact same behavior. Three people in a room, a person does something, one of the persons feels offended and the other does not. How is that? Because we have a different perception. We talk about the four defects of a conditioned soul. To make mistakes, to be illusioned, right? To cheat, and to have imperfect senses. So that means our perception of reality and reality are not the same. In fact, they're radically different. There was a scientist recently who wrote an article talking about just perception of objects. And he said, how we perceive objects is radically different from what the objects are. He compared it to looking at a computer screen, and you see a file on a computer screen, and it looks like a little rectangle with a W on it. Does that little icon on your screen have anything to do with what the file actually is? Any of you who have IT background? Nothing. What the file actually is has absolutely no relationship to what it looks like to us on the screen as a little icon. And the scientist was saying the whole world is like that. What we perceive as trees or other people is just a kind of symbol. And what it really is entirely different. So that's talking about objective things. What to speak of interpreting the behavior of other humans? We've all had the experience that we do something that gets grossly misinterpreted by somebody else. Yes? And many, many times. I mean, I can't even count how many times my words or my behavior have been grossly, sometimes interpreted exactly the opposite of what I intended. Exactly. And I'm just thinking, how can this person get this meaning from these words or from this action? You know, I'll do something to show respect and consideration for someone, and they'll take it that I show disrespect and a lack of consideration. In fact, that just happened yesterday where I was staying. So, Rachel actually washed my Didi's Achman cup and put it in the kitchen, and I said, please don't do that. So she was doing it as a favor to me. She was doing it to make me happy, but it made me unhappy. Now, at least I was able to understand that her intentions were to make me happy. But many times things like that happen, and you misjudge the person's intentions. You think, they intended to insult me. When such was never the case at all. When we think about Dhruva Maharaj, where Suruchi felt that her husband putting her stepson on his lap was a threat to her. She felt my son and my being my husband's favorite and my son getting the throne will be threatened if my husband even shows very ordinary paternal affection to his son, just to allow his son to sit on his lap. How is that threatening her? How would that threaten the royal succession? I mean, in order to keep the royal succession, her husband had to show no affection whatsoever to one of his own children? I'm sure King Uttanapad wasn't thinking, if I put Dhruva on my lap, that will mean I want him to be the king. He was just thinking as a father. If my son wants to sit on my lap, he can sit on my lap. But she took it like that. She interpreted it like that. So we interpret things different from what they are. We know that people do this to us. But we may not be aware that we do it also to others. And we do it to others pretty much all the time. We think the story in our head about what happens is the same as what happens. So we have a philosophy, I have imperfect senses, I have a cheating propensity, I make mistakes, I'll be illusioned. But we don't translate that into that in my daily interactions with others, my perception of their motives, my perception of the meaning of their actions, my perception of the meaning of their words, my perception of whether or not there is a threat, may have absolutely nothing to do with actually what's happened. So the more we're covered by the modes, the more our perception of reality is out of sync with reality. And the less we're covered by the modes, the more our perception of reality is reality. I mean, a simple example of the modes, like we have these windows. So if the windows were covered with a dark curtain, then you couldn't see out of them at all. Or maybe just a very little bit. And if they're covered with a very sheer curtain, you can see out of them, but it's distorted and it's not clear. And if it's glass, you can see clearly. But if you're outside, you can really see clearly and you get the whole picture. Because even seeing out of glass, it has a frame around it and maybe some... You know, it's difficult to keep a window absolutely clean at every moment. So the mode of ignorance is like a dark covering. People in the mode of ignorance become fearful and threatened and agitated and quarrelsome over almost anything. They react and they fight quickly. They interpret, they're so full of fear, the mode of ignorance is so full of fear. And you're so focused on just self-preservation, the anamoya and pranamoya stage, that you just, you're looking. Who's attacking? Who's attacking? Who's attacking? Who's attacking? Very, very much in a friends and enemies mentality, in a self-preservation, in a fearful mentality. And a large number of things are interpreted as a threat. So people in the mode of ignorance fight very, very easily, and a lot. It's easy to trigger them into an argument. And when they get into an argument, they'll keep on going, and going, and going, and going, and going, until they're absolutely sure that they've defeated their opponent. As Krishna says, you know, my enemy has been killed and my other enemies will be killed. This is very much the mood of somebody in the mode of ignorance. You know, imagine if you have like a big black bag over you. You're kind of walking around in this big black bag. And so anybody who touches you, you don't know who they are. You don't know what they are. You don't know what their intentions are. And so you're constantly lashing out at everyone. Then in the mode of ignorance, in mode of passion, you have some sense of dharma, some sense of righteousness, some sense of proper action. And so a person in the mode of passion wants to do the right thing. But they still have this fearfulness. It's not as great. The fearfulness is less. And if you think of someone in the mode of passion as like the Vedic kings, so they would also fight. They would have wars over things, but they were a little careful whether or not it's dharma. They were certainly interested in this self-aggrandizement. The mode of passion is very much, I want to be a great person, and I want to be worshipped and honored. But they know if I do the wrong thing, I'm not going to get worshipped. Person about ignorance is not even thinking about something like that. They don't really care. But in the mode of passion, you're going to be a little bit more hesitant. Well, if I get in a fight with this person over this thing, I may lose my reputation, or people may not like me. You know, I have to be diplomatic. Good government is very much in the mode of passion. They're very concerned with diplomacy, and allies, and they don't want to just destroy their friends over some slight thing. They're not going to start a nuclear war over some very slight problem, because that would damage their reputation. So they're interested in that. then in the mode of goodness, you actually see that everybody is a part and parcel of the Lord. You don't see friends and enemies. You see that everything that happens to you is the will of the Lord. You see that you're an eternal soul. That nobody can hurt you. And so you don't fight much about anything. Your happiness is within. In the mode of ignorance, in the mode of passion, your happiness is due to your externals, how many sense objects you get, and how much ego boosters you get from others. But in the mode of goodness, your happiness is within. Your ego is within. But still, even in the mode of goodness, there's some self-aggrandizement. I am a balanced, tolerant, forgiving person. In the mode of goodness, people will fight if somebody messes up their peaceful, harmonious situation. So they're not going to fight very often because they're mostly maintaining the peace and harmony within. But because mode of goodness is not pure and it's still based on self-aggrandizement, if the atmosphere isn't right, then they'll fight. People in the mode of goodness are dependent on an atmosphere in the mode of goodness. They can't just carry it around with them entirely. So they'll fight over that, although not nearly as often. I mean, we see in the Bhagavatam, great brahmanas in the mode of goodness also will fight, yes? You've disturbed the peacefulness of my meditation! Bikarak! And then they lose a lot of their piety. Right? Again, because mode of goodness, you're dependent on that. You're dependent that it's a peaceful atmosphere or so. Then bhakti, which is based on the glorification of the Lord, there's no self-aggrandizement. There's no self to defend. There's nothing to defend. You know, in the mode of ignorance, you're defending your immediate sense gratification and your ego to an extreme degree. In the mode of passion, you're defending your righteousness, your rightness, your dharma, and your kingdom. And the mode of goodness, you're defending your peaceful environment, the ecological balance of the earth. You're defending it because you're dependent on it. You're not defending it because you love the earth. You're defending it because you want a peaceful environment so you can be in the mode of goodness. In bhakti, one's relationship with Krishna is independent of vaitukiya pratiyata, of everything. You're not dependent on anything for it. You're carrying Krishna in your heart whether you're at Radhakund in Vrindavan or whether you're in a Soviet labor camp in Siberia. It doesn't matter. Nobody can threaten it. Nobody. There's no threat to it whatsoever. And you're not interested in self-aggrandizement. You're not interested in anybody flattering your ego or telling you that you're right. You don't need any sense objects for your enjoyment. Your enjoyment is within. So you have no need to quarrel about anything. At all, ever. And the so-called quarreling of the devotees who are in bhakti is all blissful and rasa. You know, even if the devotees are fighting against the Mayavadis, it's without any self-aggrandizement and without any of the poison that we feel when we're angry. When great devotees who are free from self-aggrandizement, or, you know, tomorrow is the appearance day or disappearance day of Blood Ritual, I think, who's mentioned in tomorrow's purport, which is really interesting. So when great devotees are fighting against impersonalism and voidism, they're doing it because they love the Lord. It's all loving. It's not about their own ego. And they don't feel, you know how when we get angry and quarrelsome, you know how it feels inside, right? Is it a nice feeling? When you're quarreling and you're fighting and you're trying to establish your own supremacy? Or the supremacy of what you believe in that's true? It's not my supremacy. Not at all. It's not about me. But how do we know it is about me? Because we have that feeling of blech inside. How do you explain it? you know, this kind of churning, isn't it? This churning and actually, chemically, we're poisoning our body and mind. But the quarreling of the devotees with the Mayavadis, Nirvasesa Sunyavadi, Paskachade Sutani. Or we'll just speak of the quarreling in the spiritual world. I was just reading Nectar Devotion this morning. That, you know, the cowherd boys are quarreling with Krishna. You're not so strong. It was the mantras of the brahmanas who held up Govardhan Hill. It wasn't you. Fight with me. And they're quarreling like that. But that's not a quarrel. It's just a chivalry rasa. It's the origin of the actual beautiful thing. That's the original form of the quarreling in this world. And glorification of the Lord takes us to this point because then it becomes about Krishna and not about me. It doesn't become about my ego and my rightness. My ego disappears. And then we all have the same center because Krishna is the center of everyone. And it creates unity in diversity. By the way, children are welcome. It creates unity in diversity. In the spiritual world, there's diversity. You know, Radharani thinks Chandravali is too mild. She doesn't fight with Krishna enough. And Chandravali thinks that Radharani is too petulant. There's diversity. There's differences of opinion. Even we did a drama in Govardhan at the retreat where I was playing Jatila. So Jatila appears to be an antagonist. There appears to be a conflict between Radharani and her friends and Jatila. But there's actually not a conflict. The center is actually Krishna. It's a game. It's fun. It's not. It's like when you have a sporting activity with a friend. You play some game with a friend and there's a mood of sportsmanship. It enhances your friendship. It enhances your love. Right? If it's done in the proper mood. So when we glorify Krishna, there's unity and diversity. We can have our different opinions and we can have our strongly held opinions and we can have our opposite opinions. But there's none of this nasty quarrel. And I've seen this. When we really glorify Krishna properly, then we find this unity and diversity. We find a unity without having to negate everyone's opinions, even though they may be radically different opinions. Chandravani and Radharani have radically different opinions about how to satisfy Krishna. Jatila and Lalita have a radically different view, or Katila and Lalita. They have a radically different view. But Krishna is satisfied. It's not that Krishna isn't satisfied by Jatila and Katila. He is. There's no demons in Goloka. You understand? And there's none of this awful poisoning that we experience in quarrel. So that's why actual glorification of Krishna, and we all experience that. We all experience that when we get together with devotees and do a certain quality of glorification of Krishna, that we all get along. And everybody is happy. And I've seen this hundreds of times. Hundreds. Everyone can be in the kirtan and everybody's happy. There's no groups and there's no parties and there's no factions and there's no anything in the kirtan. It's just kirtan. When we're talking about Krishna kirtan, the proper mood, the same thing happens. Everybody becomes happy. The whole atmosphere becomes just immediately transformed. It's instant. And I've seen this over and over and over and over again. No matter how big of a difference of opinion you have with another devotee and how much they're willing to fight with you over this particular thing or that particular thing, as soon as you go to just Krishna Katha, everyone's happy. I don't think I've ever seen an exception to this. Even in the most vicious and nasty and angry of conflicts, and I've seen some pretty heavy-duty ones. If you go to Krishna Katha, it's just immediately, it happens instantly. Just instantly. I mean, just recently, I was kind of the referee in a marital dispute. And it had gotten very intense. One of the parties was talking about divorce. I mean, it had gotten really, really intense. And it was completely over a slight misunderstanding. The wife had said something meaning one thing, and the husband had taken it to mean something else, and the husband wanted a divorce. I mean, it had become an atomic war. You know, bringing out an atom bomb to kill a mosquito kind of thing. You know, it was just... And so, first I tried to kind of calm them a little bit. Basically by coming to the point of our perception is not reality. So I first went to that. Then I just started talking about Krishna. You know, I was able to bring that into the discussion so it didn't look like I was just pulling it out of the sky, because then people would have gone, why are you talking about Krishna? Let's talk about the problem. So I was able to just kind of relate the problem to about Krishna and gradually started talking more and more about Krishna. And then everybody just relaxed and was happy and loved each other again. Within 5 minutes. Everything shifted. You could feel that the mode of ignorance just dissipated. You know, like there's a fog and the sun comes out and it just dissipates. It's just gone. And you know, when we get all worked up, it can take hours or days or weeks or months for it to dissipate. Yes. But in this case, people were really worked up. I mean, they were really, really worked up. 5-10 minutes, it was gone. It was just gone. All the agitation and the poison and the, it was just gone. And everybody was just happy. And I've seen it so many times and so consistently. But there is a way we can talk about Krishna that makes a difference. Because as I mentioned in the beginning, that I said I would get back to if I was still in my body by the end of the class. That even in religious societies there can be this kind of quarrel. And it appears to be that people are quarreling about Krishna's glorification. That's what it appears that they're quarreling about. So that it seems that the talking of the Lord is actually the instigation for the quarrel rather than the cure for the quarrel. So how do we have to talk about Krishna? Well, first of all, we have to talk about Krishna in a way that's a common ground. We have to find talk about Krishna where everybody with whom we're talking can connect. This means not going too high or too low, understanding other people's adhikar and other people's realization. It has to be appropriate. And then it has to be just to please the Lord, not to make a point. There has to be zero self-aggrandizement in it. Really, really, really zero. And you can say, well, I can't do that till I'm pure, and I say, nonsense. Anybody can do that. Anybody can talk about Krishna simply to please Krishna and be happy. And if it's done in that mood and appropriate to the time, place, and circumstance and appropriate to the people involved, if it's really on a common ground, then you have this unity and diversity. You know, mediators try to do this. I also have some training in mediation. What mediators try to do is they go more and more and more and more general until they reach a common ground. And then, because people are fighting over the specifics, so they take each party and try to get them to a wider and wider and wider and wider and wider lens till you come to some general principle that everybody agrees on. Like, everybody agrees that people should be respectful to each other. Or at least that everybody agrees everybody should be respectful to me. Which is really what we mean when we say everybody should be respectful to each other. But at least everybody will agree with that principle. And then you can go on from there. So Krishna is the super self. He's the self of the self. He's what's common to all living entities. There's a common ground there. And how not to talk about Krishna when I'm using Krishna for my self-aggrandizement. When I'm using Krishna to try to push through my agenda. Like Prabhupada said, you can write any book you want, but don't use the Bhagavad Gita to push your philosophy. Now, in order to do this, one has to have a little honest introspection, which means that one has to be engaged in the process of sadhana to themselves come to a higher platform. But what's very nice is as soon as you start talking about Krishna, you will come to a higher platform. So as soon as I start talking about Krishna, I immediately come to a higher platform, which immediately gives me the discretion as to how to talk about Krishna. Isn't that nice? It's not that first a person will have to go through, you know, lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes of austerity to reach a higher level of consciousness, and then they can talk about Krishna. As soon as we actually talk about Krishna, immediately we come to this higher level of consciousness, and then we can talk about Krishna in a way that brings real peace and harmony. So it would be a very nice thing if in our Hare Krishna movement we were setting the example for the world. That would be a good thing. You know, it's easy to look at the people messing things up in the world. There are lots of them. There are people messing things up in science, in politics, in education, any field that you, healthcare, agriculture, pick a field, any field. And people are messing it up. And it's easy for us as devotees to go, hey, you should do it this way, and fight about it, and fight with each other. Should they do it this way? Oh, they should do it that way. But if we show that the real way to have unity and diversity, to have differences of opinion, to have different points of view, to have different personalities, and yet not quarrel, is to spend a lot of our time and energy on glorifying the Lord appropriately and for the pleasure of the Lord. And then we would have a model of a society, which we do more or less. Sometimes more, sometimes less. Some places more, some places less. We can have a model of a society where when people read the books, they come to our society and they say, oh, here's the book. So all we can do is do this ourselves, but that is enough. That's enough. That's all we can do. We can't do any more than that. We can do it ourselves, but that's enough. At least if we do it ourselves, first of all, we'll be very happy people. Will be unoffendable. Wouldn't that be nice? To be unoffendable? We'll be unoffendable. We won't be bothered by the modes of passion and ignorance. We won't feel that we have to defend ourselves. So we won't quarrel over petty things. We won't be influenced by this anger and this upsetness and this fear. And people who contact us, at least some of them, will think, wow, that's what it was like being around Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada was unoffendable. Prabhupada didn't argue on the basis of false ego and self-aggrandizement, and he wasn't like that. And Prabhupada was talking about, you know, impersonalism or feminism or whatever he was talking about that he was saying was wrong, his mood was not self-aggrandizement and his mood was not ego. His mood was compassion and care and protection and love. And you felt that from Srila Prabhupada. Even if Prabhupada was telling you you were wrong, it wasn't that kind of an ego thing. And so you felt, I want to be like that. And there's so many devotees in our Hare Krishna movement who are like that. Not that anyone can be like Srila Prabhupada, but like that. There are many devotees in our movement who are absorbed in Krishna Katana, who are absorbed in Krishna's name, fame, qualities, and pastimes. And who are unoffendable, maybe not entirely, but to a large extent. That there's so much situated in Satvaguna, or there's so much situated in Bhakti, that they're not prone to be involved in these kind of things. They don't have this self-aggrandizement. This is not 100%, just even if they're to a very great percent. Then we also think, wow, yeah, that's what I want. Krishna consciousness is real. And the more of us that can do this, then the more and more our society will be attractive. You know, we have a lot of quarrels in our Hare Krishna movement about how to preach and how to make devotees. I would like to suggest that the main way of how to preach would be if we glorified the Supreme Lord and if the vast majority of us were unoffendable. The main thing that turns people off to joining a spiritual organization is the quarrels and the pettiness. Not what we wear, what we eat. People are not going to join our movement or not join our movement by whether or not we serve pizza. They can get pizza anywhere. I mean, literally, you can get pizza anywhere. Somehow Italian cuisine has taken over the world. You can buy pizza in Mayapur. And it's not, you know, do we wear blue jeans or do we wear dhoti? That's not the main thing. I mean, maybe for the initial meeting, but that's not the main thing. The main thing is, are we in bhakti? Is it a haven? Is it an oasis from Kali? Can you come to our movement? Not everybody is not going to be on that platform, obviously. But, you know, we should have at least a critical mass. And if we have that in our movement, people come and see, wow, these people have unity and diversity. They're personalists. They have different opinions. They have different personalities. They have different ways of doing things. But they're all blissfully glorifying the Lord. And they meet on that platform. And they're able to settle their differences, and they're able to reconcile their differences and work together on this common ground of glorification. Krishna without self-aggrandizement. And you know, if we did that, we're already doing that to a large extent, but if we could do that to a great extent, if instead of 10 or 20% of our members being on that platform, if it was 80% of our members being on that platform, then we could go to people in the world and say, hey, like this. My daughter-in-law's parents, Prabhupada Palamula Bhakriti, asked Srila Prabhupada one time, how should we preach? Prabhupada said, invite people to your home for 3 days and say, do what we do. So we should be able to invite people to our Hare Krishna society and say, like this. So questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions, chastisements, quarrels. Yes.
Krishna says that there's, what I understand is that there's two types of Krishna Katha, one which is spoken by Krishna but about him.
Mm-hmm.
Just in regards to understand what quality of hearing the glories of Krishna will stop these quarrels, like, would a forum like this, where we're not necessarily, like, of course you've had examples in there where we're describing some of the pastimes, you know, would that be considered as that quality which will solve the quarrels? You know, how about discussions in our service, which are not directly glorifying the Lord, but in service to glorify Him? Is there, like, any clear cut?
Just speaking from my own personal experience of spending my entire adult life in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, I'd say the more direct it is, the more powerful it is. That's my own personal experience. When you start talking about Krishna's footprints marking the dust of Vrindavan, and Krishna herding his cows in the forest, and the Yamuna River, you know, and Mahaprabhu dancing in Kirtan, everything is good. Could that be the case with these other things? Yes, but the problem is these other things tend to have a little bit more of a danger of self-aggrandizement in them. Whereas these other things generally don't. They can. They can. You could be thinking I'm talking about Krishna's pastimes because I'm a very advanced devotee or something like that. You know what I mean? They can. They certainly can. But it's a little harder. It's a little harder. And it's an area. So that's at least my experience. Is it possible for all of those to have that effect? Yes, but it's the more you go just to nam guna rupa lila, the more it dissipates all of it. The clouds just go away, and they go away almost instantly. I've seen the effect, I've experienced the effect so many times now that I'm personally convinced of it. It's just, and it's consistent. It always happens. It always happens, and it always happens very, very quickly. With what the others are talking about, not, I don't find that. If we're just talking about, you know, should we put the tent over here, should we put the tent over there, and, you know, where should we rent the chairs from, and are we going to have kofta or samosas? I haven't found that kind of conversation. It could, but I haven't found it that absolutely always instantly that kind of effect is. Yes?
Manji, thanks very much. That was a really well spoken class, and I enjoyed the...
For the well spoken part, yeah. You have to thank Mr. Gerald Lasso.
How so?
Because the late Mr. Gerald Lasso was my speech coach.
Nice.
And I had 3 years of very intense training in public speaking under his direction. He had every year, everybody under his direction won championships. I won the state championship, I won the district championship, got up to the quarterfinals and the national championship. But that was 100% due to him. So any well-spokenness that you hear or see in me, all of the credit goes to him. May he attain Krishna consciousness in whatever body he is at present.
So please excuse my inadequacies, I've not had a speech coach. I just wanted to ask you in relation to quarrel, if you are misinterpreted, as you described, is so common in the age of Kali, how much should you endeavor to clarify your position?
Oh, what a wonderful question. It depends on the nature of your relationship with the person who is misinterpreting you. As a general principle, the best way to be situated in sattva-gun and please the Lord is to never defend ourselves, ever. Especially when we are wrongly accused, which is when we want to defend ourselves the most. Never. Just never. With one exception. When defending ourselves is necessary to prevent harm to somebody else. So recently I had a devotee ask me, have you heard so-and-so nasty rumor about such-and-such ISKCON leader? And I said, I have never even heard a whisper of such a thing. Said devotee then wrote an email to other people, Urmila is making such and such accusations against such and such ISKCON leader. And I wrote back to him, I said, Prabhu, the only time I ever heard this accusation was from you. I already told you I'd never even heard it. Why are you saying that I'm making the accusation when I've never even heard the accusation? And he said, well, somebody told me that you said it. And I said, well, then somebody's lying, either me or them. And if someone's lying, and you don't know who's lying, how can you repeat it? But then I thought, well, he's told all these other people that I've said it. He's spread it all over that I've said these things. And I felt in that case I needed to clarify things, not to defend myself, but because otherwise this other devotee would be harmed. You follow? Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I put up an announcement, I have never said anything against this devotee. But other than a case where people misinterpreting us or accusing us will harm somebody else, but we have to rectify it for someone else's harm, or some kind of, there'll be some kind of scandal or whatever, if the truth is not known, never defend yourself. Now, what you can do in a situation where the relationship will be harmed is you can simply affirm that you value the relationship without defending yourself. When we stop defending ourselves absolutely, we're very much situated in sattva. And we become very happy and very joyful, and Krishna consciousness becomes very, very easy. So, to allow people to think you're terrible. But if the relationship is important, you definitely want to clarify that you value the relationship and you value the principles of the relationship, although you don't try to excuse you don't try to make excuses for yourself. So it's a fine line, but you can feel the difference. It's a very subjective, but very easy to discern difference between the feeling we have when we're defending ourselves out of fear, and the feeling we have where we're reassuring somebody that I've meant you no harm, and I value the relationship, and I respect you, without defending our actions at all, even to any iota of defense. Let Krishna defend you if he wants to defend you. And it's an amazing platform that one can. So the only exception would be if defending myself was necessary in order to prevent some other scandal or some other harm. And so, it's quite a magical thing, actually. I mean, that's the basis of the Trinada piece, Sunichana, Tori, Vasa, Vishnu, Amanina, Mani, Dana, Kirti, Vyasada. Is being unoffendable. And we want to defend ourselves because we're afraid if I'm misunderstood, this person won't like me anymore, and I'll have some damage to myself. That's very different from I want to make sure this person is happy. It's quite a difference. So one is fear based and ego based, and one is love based. So to say, I have no intention to hurt you. I really value your opinion. I really value what you have to say. You know, I think you're a very good and responsible person. It's very different. I didn't mean that. Well, I actually meant this. And you didn't understand me. It's a different mood. I mean, sometimes it can be just a very simple thing. No, I said I meant 4 o'clock. You know, that's a different kind of thing. You know, if it's a real simple thing and there's not any ego involved at all, then that's just clarification with that. You know what I'm saying? Can you understand the difference?
Yes.
You can tell how you feel. It's very much how do you get that feeling. If that's not there, it's just a simple thing. And no, this is what I meant. I meant we should meet at 4 o'clock. Oh, okay. So that's fine. As long as you don't get into it. As long as it's not a mood of I'm defending my ego to protect myself. And you can work at being very sensitive to this. And sometimes when you have the time, when it's something in writing and you have a little time, it's sometimes easier, where you may be inclined to just write something. And you might even first write it, but before you click the send, stop, assess, how do I feel? What mode am I in? Am I in a fearful, defensive place? Don't do it. Because then it's coming from a distorted perception of reality. Stop. Okay. There is a problem here. It needs to be solved. How can I solve it? In a way that I'm just concerned about the other person, not about my ego. Let them think of me whatever they want, but let me not be an agent to hurt their feelings. Because that's one of the... We're not supposed to give anxiety to others. So I don't want to inadvertently give anxiety to somebody else by their misunderstanding of me. But if they still think that I'm a demon and a rascal, that's okay. Is that...
Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
So then, Mataji, in following that, how would one find the Krishna conscious way to assert, or be assertive, as opposed to trying not to defend and remove yourself from that? If you feel strongly enough about something in the right mood, for the right reasons, how would one...
If you're in the... you're going to think this is a terrible answer. You may hate me for this answer. If it's actually in the might mode for the right reasons, you will know. Lack of clarity is due to the lower modes, according to Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. When in the mode of ignorance, you think what's right is wrong and what's wrong is right. And you're really convinced of it. And in the mode of passion, you're kind of confused. In the mode of goodness, you can see what's binding, what's liberating, what's good, what's bad. In bhakti, you really see everything was pleasing to Krishna. How do you know what mode you're in? When you're in the mode of goodness, you feel how? Peaceful and joyful and compassionate and humble. That's how you feel. So if you don't feel like that, then if you think you're right for the right reasons, you're wrong. It's like Prabhupada said, you don't have to get a certificate from others as to whether or not you're Krishna conscious, just like you don't need a certificate from someone else as to whether or not you've eaten enough. You don't have to sit there, did I have enough food? I mean, unless you have some kind of disease. Some people have a disease that they can't tell. But for most of us, if our bodies are functioning reasonably normally, we can tell when we're full. We can tell when we're Krishna conscious. When we're Krishna conscious, we're full of joy, we're full of peace, we're full of courage, we're not fearful. We have love and compassion, we understand others, we can actually connect with them. And we know automatically how to present things properly. And Krishna says, it's like the sun lights up everything the day. You automatically know how to behave. In the very beginning of Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada says it's especially very necessary in the very beginning that you have to have authorities that they're in the proper consciousness. And they say, behave like this, behave like this, behave like this, and you have to just do it. But we should come to the point where our duties are self-illuminated. And we should be able to judge. Am I hungry or full? Just like materially, you can all tell if you're hungry or full. You're all hungry right now and you want me to be quiet. So spiritually it's also like that. We should be able to tell, am I hungry or full? Am I agitated? Am I disturbed? Am I fearful? Am I angry? Vajravegam, anasaprotavegam, jivavegam, udurapastavegam. Am I being pushed? There's a feeling, yes? Isn't it? Isn't there a feeling when anger has got out its whip and pushing you around? Pride. Don't we know what that feels like? We should know what that feels like. And there's a feeling when it's not. There's a feeling when it's Krishna. Ramabhuta prasanatma, misojati nikanchati. So you can say there's objectively, what does it say in the Shastra, what does it say by the sadhus, what does it say by the acharyas, and that's important, that's essential, it's not just subjective, but it's also subjective. It's both. So if you're sure from sadhu, Shastra, guru, if you're sure on that platform, you better be sure on the subjective platform also. You better be sure on the internal, your internal consciousness platform also. Better be sure on both platforms. Not just the subjective and not just the objective. Both. Holistically, if you will. Is that all right? I'm sorry if you didn't like the answer. Yes, and then we'll stop here because I'm past when I thought I would definitely end.
Where you don't defend yourself, what do you do? Do you just walk away or you be apologetic?
Silence is a very good one.
Yes.
Silence is the best.
Sometimes silence actually aggravates things more.
Therefore, you have to have a little intelligence. Like, I love the letter Prabhupada wrote where he said, use your common sense, and if you don't have any, ask someone who does. So, you need to decide, but generally, silence is the best. Generally, just a non-response. You could say something about something else, but silence on that. Like, let's say somebody writes me an email, we'll just say theoretically this happens, okay? Let's say somebody writes me a theoretical email where they're bringing up certain important points that we need to discuss, and they're also attacking my character and criticizing me. So I can respond only to the parts that are about relevant, and I can completely and totally ignore they're attacking and they're blaming of me. And just ignore it. I can just pretend that it's not there. Which can be very difficult if they're falsely attacking me and falsely blaming me, and if they're falsely attacking me on something that's very important to my feeling of security and self-identity. But I can just choose to be silent on those things. That generally, that's the best response. Generally. There are some exceptions, and you know. We're not machines, we're people. But the principle is, don't defend your ego. That's what we're trying to get rid of. All of us who walked in this door, we walked in this door because we want to get rid of our false ego. We became convinced somehow or other that our false ego is the whole source of all of our problems. Isn't that why we're all here? Anybody here theoretically want to keep their false ego? In theory. No. We all want to get rid of it. So then you say, wow, a good opportunity. Somebody's blaming me for something I didn't do. Somebody's wrong. There's someone out there who's wrong. There's someone out there who's criticizing me wrongly. There's someone out there who's wrong, and they're wrong about something that's really, really, really important. Oh, this is a good opportunity to get rid of some of my false ego. Blessed are the fighting opportunities that come unsought, opening for the Kshatriyas the doors to the heavenly kingdom. Blessed are the Vaishnavas to whom opportunities to their false ego come unsought, opening for them the doors to Goloka Vrindavan. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
The Grace Mother Urmila Mataji.